the quilts and squirmed back, welcoming her in. It had rained earlier, and the night chill of her was delicious. She settled solidly into his arms with a shudder of relaxation, and his hand settled contentedly on her lovely, blooming belly. Mama says cats are attracted to people working so they can get in the way. I guess I'm the only person in the house who was doing anything at this hour. He breathed near her ear. You smell like ink, so you must have been writing, not drawing. Letters.
No, just, you know, thoughts.
Maybe something for the kids' book, maybe not.
She was trying to sound casual, but mention of the practical guide for time travelers brought him to full wakefulness.
Oh, he said, cautious. Do I want to know?
Probably not, she said frankly, but I'd like to tell you about it. It could wait until morning, though.
As if something like coherent conversation happens in the morning round here, he said, and rolled onto his back, yawning. All right, tell me.
Well, you remember I was thinking about the problem of math?
Dimly, yes. I don't recall what you decided, though.
I didn't, she said frankly. I just don't know enough, and there are a lot of problems with the hypothesis that I don't have a way to resolve. But it made me think about what math is. His eyes were closed, but his hand slid down her back and cupped her behind, warm and substantial. He jiggled it gently.
There's some. I'm pretty sure that's math.
Yes. So's that. She slid her hand down between them and cupped his testicles, lightly, but it made him open his eyes.
Point taken,
he said, and moved his hand to the small of her back.
So?
What do you think happens to us when we die? That woke him completely, though it took a moment to assemble words.
When we die, he said slowly. If you mean in terms of our souls, the basic truth is that we don't know. But we do have faith that we'll go on existing, and we have a pretty good reason for having said faith. But that's not what you mean, is it?
No. I mean bodies, physically. He changed metaphysical gears, not without a small sense of clashing and grinding.
You mean something other than just decay?
Well, no, that is what I mean. But kind of beyond rotting. He rolled onto his side and she followed, nestling under his chin, much like Adso, but with better-smelling hair.
Beyond rotting? This is the kind of thing that keeps you up at night. God, what kind of dreams do you have? You're the scientist here, but so far as I know, the process just goes on. What, dissolving?
Dissolution, yes, exactly.
You know, normal people talk about sex in bed, don't they?
Most of them probably talk about what horrible thing their child did during the day, the price of tobacco, or what to do about the sick cow, if they can stay awake. Anyway, I only had the required physics classes in college, so this is pretty basic and it may be completely wrong and
nobody will ever be able to prove it one way or the other, so let's not trouble about that part, he suggested.
Good thought. And speaking of smelling, she turned her head and snuffled gently at his neck. You smell like gunpowder. You haven't been hunting, have you? Her voice held a certain amount of incredulity. Not without reason, but he was slightly nettled.
I have not. Yada asked me to show a cravat how to load his new musket and fire it without knocking his teeth out.
Cyrus Crombie, she said. Why? Da isn't conscripting him into his gang, is he?
I believe partisan band is the proper term, Roger said primly. And no, Hiram asked Jamie to take the boy on and teach him to fight. With a gun and dirk, that is. He said if it was a matter of fists, any fisherman could lay a landsman out like a flatfish without half trying. And he's probably right. But none of the Thirso folk had ever even held a gun before coming here. And most of them still haven't. They fish and snare and trade for meat.
Do you think Hiram made him, or was it Cyrus's own idea?
The latter.
He's courting Frances in his own inimitable way, but he knows he hasn't a chance unless Jadar thinks he'll make her a good husband. So he means to prove his mettle.
How old is he? Brianna asked, a note of concern in her voice.
16, I think, Roger said. Old enough to fight, so far as that goes.
So far as that goes, she muttered, huffing a little under her breath, and he knew why.
Jamie won't be old enough to ride with them before the war's over, he assured her, no matter how good he is with a gun.
Great, so he can stay and guard the ramparts here with me, Rachel and Aunt Jenny and the Sachem while the partisan band and Mama, because she won't let Dar go alone, and probably you, go roaming the countryside getting their asses shot off?
As you were saying about your physics class.
Oh.
She paused to regather her thoughts, a small soft frown between her brows.
Well, you know all about atoms and electrons and that sort of thing.
Vaguely.
Well, there are smaller things than that. Subatomic particles, but nobody knows how many or exactly how they work. But while we were hearing about that in class, the instructor said something about how everything in the universe, and probably even if there's more than one universe, everything is made of stardust. People, plants, planets, and stars, I suppose.
Stardust not being a scientific term, she added, just in case he'd thought it was.
Just that everything is composed of the same infinitesimal bits of matter.
Yes.
So what I'm thinking is, maybe that's what happens when someone steps through a time place. I'm almost sure that it's an electromagnetic phenomenon of some kind because of the ley lines.
Ley lines?
He was surprised.
I wouldn't think you'd be running into those in a physics class.
She rolled a little in order to look up at him. Her breath tickled the hairs on his chest and warmed his neck as she talked. She'd grown warm with talking. He could feel the vibration of words through her back as she spoke. It was curiously arousing.
Ley line is a kind of an informal term, but you know that the Earth's crust is magnetic, right?
I can't say I did, but I'm willing to take your word for it.
You may. And you do know that magnets are directional? Did you play with them as a kid?
You mean positive end, negative end? And if you put the positive ends of two magnets together, they bounce apart?
Yes.
What has that got to do with ley lines?
That's what a ley line is, she said patiently. The electromagnetism in the Earth runs in parallel bands, and the bands alternate in the direction of their magnetic current. Though it's not totally neat and tidy, of course. They diverge and overlap, and like that.
Haven't I told you this stuff before?
Possibly.
He abandoned his half-formed amorous intentions with a sense of regret.
But the ley lines I know about are, I don't know what you'd call them in terms of classification, folklore, ancient builder stuff, at least in the British Isles. If you go looking at ancient hill forts and churches that are probably built on much older sites of worship and, well, things like standing stones, you often find that you can draw a straight, very straight, in most cases, as though it had been surveyed, line through two or three, four such sites. Archaeologists call those ley lines, though some folk call them spirit walks because the dead are thought to... Oh, my God.
A brief, uncontrollable shudder ran through him. Goose walking on your grave? She asked, sympathy slightly marred by a look of satisfaction.
Not everybody makes it,
he said, ignoring both sympathy and smugness. He pushed back the covers and sat up.
Through the stones. That's what you mean. That the people who don't go through, or don't go through properly, turn up dead on these ley lines, leading to the not unreasonable supposition that there's something supernatural going on.
I hadn't heard of spirit walks, she admitted, so I
can't say that's what I mean, but it makes sense, doesn't it? She didn't wait for him to admit it, but went on with her own line of thought. So, I'm thinking that the time places are maybe spots where different ley lines converge. If so, what happens to the electromagnetism in that spot would be really interesting, and it might be what makes time be accessible. I mean, Einstein's unified field theory.
Let's leave Albert out of it, he said hastily, at least for now.
All right, she said agreeably. Einstein never got it to work anyway. All I'm saying is, maybe when you walk into one of those places, if you have the right genetics for it, you, die. Physically. You dissolve into stardust, if you want to call it that, and your particles can pass through stone because they're smaller than the atoms that make up the stones. Roger felt a distinct lurch in his insides at the memory of what it felt like. Being dead wasn't putting it too strongly, but...
But we come out again, he pointed out. If we die, we don't stay dead.
Well, some of us don't. She'd sat up, too, arms curled around her knees. If we believe Ottertooth's journal and that skunk Wendigo Donner, some of their companions made it through the stones but came out dead. And there are all those incidents in Galus Duncan's journal. Strange people, often in odd clothes, turning up dead near stone circles.
Aye,
he said, with that faint internal squirm that affected him when his green-eyed five-times-great-grandmother was mentioned.
So you think you have a notion why that doesn't happen to everybody?
I'm not sure it amounts to that much, she admitted. But it kind of goes along with what you were saying about what Christians believe, that we go on living after death. If you think about what it feels like, she swallowed, in there, you feel like you're coming apart, but you're trying as hard as you can not to, to keep your sense of your body, I guess.
Yes, he said.
So maybe what we are in there is the immortal part of us, souls, if you like.
As a Christian minister, I like it fine,
he said, trying for some semblance of normality in this conversation. Like it or not, he was remembering that spectral cold, and the skin down his arms and legs prickled with goose flesh.
So?
Well, see, I think that's maybe where the gemstones come in, she explained. She moved closer to him, putting a warm hand on his bare and prickling leg. You know what it feels like when they burn up, when the chemical bonds between their molecules, or maybe their atoms, or subatomic particles are breaking. And when you break a chemical bond, it releases a lot of energy. Since it's releasing that energy inside our clouds of dissolving stuff, maybe...
Maybe that's what keeps the bits of our bodies together, you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And this just occurred to me. She turned to him, eyes widening. Maybe you can lose a few bits in transit, but still make it out, just with a little damage, like an irregular heartbeat. Neither of them spoke for a bit, contemplating.
You are hiding that book, right?
He asked. This discussion was disquieting enough. Thought of having the same discussion with Jemmy made his stomach turn over. Yes, she assured him. I was hiding it in the bottom of my sketch box. But even Mandy knows how to open that now.
Maybe they wouldn't be interested. I mean, it's not got a title or pictures.
She shot him a sharp glance. Don't you believe it. Kids snoop. I mean, maybe you didn't, being a goody-goody preacher's lad. She was laughing at him, but dead serious underneath. But I went through my parents' stuff all the time. I mean, I knew what size my mother's brassieres and panties were.
Well, that would have been well worth knowing.
No, I did too, he admitted.
Not about the Reverend's underpants. He wore long johns with buttons year round. But I learned a lot of really interesting things I wasn't supposed to know, mostly about the Reverend's congregation. He gave me my dad's letters from the war when I was about 13. But I'd read them 2 or 3 years before, from his desk.
Really? She said, diverted. Did you wear long johns with buttons, too?
Me and every other young lad in Inverness in the 1940s. You know how cold it gets up there in the winter. But actually, when I was about 13, I found a trunk of my dad's old RAF uniform stuff that they'd sent home when he disappeared.
He swallowed, stabbed by the unexpected memory of the last time,
and it was the last, he was sure,
he'd seen his father.
There were a few pairs of underpants amongst the other things. The Reverend told me the flyers called them shreddies. God knows why. But they looked like what you'd call boxer shorts. I took to wearing those in the summers.
Shreddies, she said, tasting the word with pleasure. I'm not sure whether I'd rather see you in those or in the button front long johns. Anyway, I've been hiding it in Dad's study.
Everybody's afraid to mess around in there, except Mama. And I suppose I ought to show this to her anyway, when I've thought it out a little further. To be honest, I think seeing whatever you're writing would give your Da the absolute whim-whams.
Like the whole thing doesn't anyway?
And he's not the only one,
Roger thought. A cool draught of rain-scented air from the window touched his back.
You told me that when a scientist makes a hypothesis, the next thing to do is test it, right?
Yes.
If you think of a way to test this one, don't tell me, I.
Chapter 127. Imte, Ravelous Day, Annual May, Observation K, of Way, Asme, N. Energy. The next day, Roger came down from the malting floor in search of beer for Jamie and Ian, and found Rihanna in Jamie's office writing. She looked up at him, frowning, pencil in hand.
How old is Pig Latin, do you know?
No idea. Why?
He looked over her shoulder at the page.
Imte, Ravelous Day, Annual May, Observation K, of Way, Asme, N, Energy. Time Traveller's Manual? He asked, looking at her sideways.
She was flushed and had a deep line showing between her brows, neither of which detracted from her appeal. She nodded, still frowning at the page.
What we were talking about last night, it gave me a thought, and I wanted to put it down before I lost it, but...
You don't want to risk anybody stumbling over it and reading it, he finished for her.
Yeah, but it still needs to be something the kids, or Jemmy at least, can read if necessary.
So tell me your valuable thought,
he suggested, and sat down very slowly. He'd been working at the still with Jamie for the last 3 days, hauling bags of barley, then carrying the cases of rifles. Jamie had got another 20 through the good offices of Scotchy Cameron, from their hiding place under the malting floor, down to the stable cave, and finally unpacking and cleaning said rifles. He ached from neck to knees.
So you don't know anything about Pig Latin, she said, eyeing him skeptically. Do you remember what I told you about the principle of the conservation of mass?
He closed his eyes and mimed writing on a blackboard.
Matter is neither created nor destroyed, he said, and opened his eyes. That it?
Well done.
She patted his hand, then noticed its state, grimy and curled into a half fist, his fingers stiff from gripping the rough burlap bags. She pulled his hand into her lap, unfolded the fingers, and began to massage them.
The whole formal thing says... The law of conservation of mass states that for any system closed to all transfers of matter and energy, the mass of the system must remain constant over time, as the system's mass cannot change, so quantity can neither be added nor removed.
Roger's eyes were half closed in a mingling of tiredness and ecstasy.
God, that feels good.
Good. So what I'm thinking is this. Time travellers definitely have mass, right? So if they're moving from one time to another, does that mean the system is momentarily unbalanced in terms of mass? I mean, Does 1780 have 425 more pounds of mass in it than it ought to have? And conversely, 1982 has 425 pounds too little.
Is that how much we weigh altogether?
Roger opened his eyes.
I've often thought the kids each weighed that much all by themselves.
I'm sure they do, she said, smiling, but unwilling to lose her train of thought.
And of course I'm making the assumption that the dimension of time is part of the definition of system.
Here, give me the other one.
It's filthy, too.
It was, but she merely pulled a handkerchief from her bosom and wiped the mixture of grease and dirt from his fingers. Why are your fingers so greasy?
If you're sending something like a rifle across an ocean, you pack it in grease to keep the salt air and water from eroding it. Or guano dust getting into the mechanism.
Blessed Michael defend us, she said, and despite the fact that she obviously meant it, he laughed at her Bostonian Gallic accent.
It's all right, he assured her, swallowing a yawn. The rifles are safe. Go on with the conservation of mass. I'm fascinated.
Sure you are. Her long, strong fingers probed and rubbed, pulling his joints and avoiding, for the most part, his blisters. So, you remember Galis's grimoire, right? And the records you kept of bodies that were found in or near stone circles?
That woke him up.
I do.
Well, if you move a chunk of mass into a different time period, do you maybe have to balance that by removing a different chunk?
He stared at her, and she looked back, still holding his hand but no longer massaging it. Her eyes were steady, expectant.
You're saying that if someone comes through a portal, someone else from that time has to die to keep the balance right?
Not exactly. She resumed her massage, slower now, because even if they die, their mass is still there. I'm sort of thinking that maybe that's what keeps them from passing through, though. They're headed for a time that doesn't have room for them. In terms of mass?
And they can't go through, and that kills them.
There seems something illogical in this, but his brain was in no condition to say what. Not that exactly either. Brianna lifted her head, listening, but whatever she'd heard, the sound wasn't repeated. And she went on, bending her head to peer into his palm.
Man, you have huge blisters.
I hope they heal up by the ordination. Everybody will be shaking your hand afterward. But think about it. Most of the bodies in Galis's news clippings were unidentified and mostly wearing odd clothes. He stared at her for a moment, then took his hand from hers and flexed it gingerly.
So, you think they came from somewhere, sometime else, and got through the stones but then died?
Or, she said delicately, they came from this time, but they knew where they were going, or where they thought they were going. Because plainly they didn't make it there. So, you know.
How did they find out that they maybe could go?
He finished for her. He glanced down at her notebook.
Maybe more people read Pig Latin than you think.
Chapter 128. Surrender. Fraser's Ridge, June 21st, 1780. Roger was seated in the family privy, not from bodily necessity, but from an urgent need for 5 minutes of solitude. He could, he supposed, have gone into the woods, or taken momentary refuge in the root cellar or the spring house. But the house and all its surroundings were boiling with humanity, and he needed just these few minutes to be by himself. Not by any means alone, but not with people. Davy Caldwell had arrived last night with the Reverends Peterson from Savannah and Thomas from Charlestown. The house was as prepared as half a dozen determined women could make it. The church had been cleaned and aired and filled with so many flowers that half of Claire's bees were zooming in and out of the window like tiny crop dusters. The scents of barbecued pork, vinegar and mustard slaw and fried onions drifted through the cracks in the walls, making his stomach twitch in anticipation. He closed his eyes and listened. To the sounds of the festivities gearing up, the distant rumble of people talking, the fiddle and drums tuning up by Claire's garden, even the loud nasal drone of a bagpipe in the distance. That was all Charlie Wallace, who would pipe the ministers into church and pipe them out again, their number augmented by one. He'd been uncertain about the piping, giving the Reverend Thomas's opinions regarding music in church, but Jamie, of all people, had said that he didn't think the sound of the pipes should really be called music.
"People dance to it," Bree had said, amused.
"Aye, well, folk will dance to anything if you give them enough liquor," her father replied. "The British government says the pipes are a weapon of war, though, and they'll no just say they're wrong. Put it this way, lass, you can, I dinna hear music, but I hear what the pipes are saying fine."
Roger smiled, hearing this in memory. Jamie wasn't wrong, and neither had been the British government.
"Fitting," he thought, and closed his eyes. He was under no illusions that what he was about to do wasn't one, and an important one, of innumerable steps on the road to a great battle.
"Yes,"
he thought in reply to a silent question he'd answered before, would answer again, however often it came, and he knew it would.
"Yes, I'm scared. And yes, I will."
And in the stillness of his beating heart, all sounds faded into a great, encompassing peace. Jamie had seen an ordination once in Paris, in the great cathedral. He had gone with Annalise de Marillac, whose brother Jacques was one of the ordinands, and consequently had had a place with her family from which he could see everything. He remembered it vividly, though in honesty his memories of the early parts of the ceremony were mostly of Annalise's bosom and her perfumed, excited warmth throbbing beside him. He was sure that getting a cockstand in a cathedral must be some sort of sin, but as he'd been too embarrassed to explain it in confession, he had let it pass under the guise of impure thoughts. He cleared his throat, glanced at Claire, and straightened up. This ceremony was quite different, of course, and yet at the heart of it, it was strikingly the same. The words were in English, not Latin, but they said similar things. "Grace to you, and peace from God our Father, and the Lord Jesus Christ. Sisters and brothers in Christ, we come together with thanksgiving as congregation and presbytery to praise the Lord who has brought us to this day of the ordination of Roger Jeremiah Mackenzie as minister of this congregation and parish. Notre Dame de Paris had a mighty organ and many choristers." He remembered how the sound had shaken the air and seemed to quiver in his bones. Here there was no music, but the calls of birds that came through the open windows, no incense save the smell of pine boards, and the pleasant tang of soap and sweat among the people. Brianna, on his left, smelled of flour and apples, and Claire, on his right, carried her usual varying scent of green things and flowers. From the corner of his eye he caught a wee movement. A bee had landed on her head, just above her ear. She lifted a hand absently to brush at the ticklish feeling, but he caught the hand and held it for a few seconds till the bee flew away. She glanced at him, surprised, but smiled, and looked back at what was going on in front of them. The elder ministers spoke, one at a time, and they laid their hands on Roger Mack, touching his head, his shoulders, his hands. Just so the bishop had laid his hands on the young priests, and he felt the same sense of awe, recognizing what was happening. This was the keeping of a word that had been kept for centuries, the passing on of a solemn trust, that the man to whom it was given would keep it too, forever. He felt tears come to his eyes and bit his lip to hold them back. "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, he gave us new birth into a living hope. Lord our God, we praise you for Christ the Lord.
We praise you for the fellowship of the church. We praise you for the faith handed down as one generation to another tells of your mighty acts. We praise you for the worship offered throughout the world. We praise you for the witness and service of the saints through the ages. Lord our God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, we praise you. Amen. In Paris, the young men, there had been 20, he'd counted them, prostrated themselves in their clean white garments, lying face down on the stone floor, hands raised above their heads, submitting themselves, surrendering. God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, you call us in your mercy, you sustain us by your power. Through every generation your wisdom supplies our need. You sent your only Son, Jesus Christ, to be the apostle and high priest of our faith and the shepherd of our souls. By his death and resurrection, he has overcome death, and, having ascended into heaven, has poured out his Spirit, making some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, to equip all for the work of ministry and to build up his body, the church. We pray you now to pour out your Holy Spirit upon this your servant, Roger Jeremiah, whom we now, in your name and in obedience to your will, by the laying on of hands, ordain and appoint to the office of the holy ministry within the one holy, Catholic, and Apostolic Church, committing to him authority to minister your word and sacraments. These were Presbyterians and not given to spectacle. Roger Mack drew a deep breath and closed his eyes, and Jamie trembled as he felt the witness of surrender cleave his heart. Warm drops struck his hands, folded in his lap, but he didn't care. A murmur of awe and joy rose up from the church, and Roger Mack stood up, his own face wet with tears and shining like the sun. It was nearly midnight before we reached our bed. I could still hear the celebrations going on in the distance, though by now the random gunfire had ceased, and it was just singing, of a very non-religious nature, with a single fiddle dodging in and out among the voices. I was nearly dead with fatigue and the aftermath of strong emotion. I couldn't imagine how Brianna, let alone Roger, was still on her feet, but I'd seen them on my way back to the house, wrapped in each other's arms, and kissing in the shadow of a big black walnut. I wondered vaguely whether the profound emotion of ordination normally turned into sexual desire, if the legitimate object of it was at hand, and what young, new Catholic priests might do to express their own elation. I shed my clothes and pulled a clean night rail over my head, sighing in quiet ecstasy at having nothing but air on my corset-constricted body. My head popped out, and I saw Jamie, lying on the bed in his own shirt. His head was cocked toward the window, and he looked rather wistful. I wondered whether he'd rather be down there dancing, but I couldn't imagine why he wouldn't be there if that was the case. What are you thinking? He looked up and smiled at me. He'd undone his formal queue, and his hair lay over his shoulders, sparkling in the candlelight. Ugh! I was just wondering whether I shall ever hear Mass said again. Oh, I tried to think. When was the last time? At Jocasta's wedding?
I think so.
Catholicism was prohibited in most of the colonies, bar Maryland, which had been founded specifically as a Catholic colony. Even there, the Anglican Church was the official church, and Catholic priests were few and far between in the southern colonies. It won't always be like this, I said, and began to massage his shoulders slowly. Brianna's told you about the Constitution, hasn't she? It will guarantee freedom of religion, among other things.
She recited the beginning of it to me.
He sighed and bent his head, inviting me to rub the long, tight muscles of his neck.
We the people. Brawly written. I hope to meet Mr. Jefferson some day, though I think he might have stolen the odd phrase here and there, and some of his ideas have a familiar ring to them.
Montesquieu might have had some minor influence, I said, amused.
and I believe I've heard John Locke spoken of as well. He glanced over his shoulder at me, one brow raised.
Aye, that's it. I shouldn't have thought you'd read either one, Sassenach.
Well, I haven't, I admitted. But I didn't go to school in America, only medical school, and they don't teach you history there, bar the history of medicine, where they point out horrible examples of benighted thinking and horrific practices, virtually all of which I've actually used now and then, bar blowing tobacco smoke up someone's bottom. Can't think how I missed that one. I coughed. But Bree learned all about American history in the 5th and 6th grades, and more in high school. She's the one who told me about Mr. Jefferson's light-fingered ways with words. But then there's Benjamin Franklin. I think at least some of his quotes were original. I remember, "You have a republic, if you can keep it." That's what he said, will say, at the end of the war. But they, we, did keep it. At least for the next 200 years. Maybe longer.
"Something like that is worth fighting for, aye?"
he said, and squeezed my hand. I put out the candle and slid into bed beside him, every muscle in my body dissolving in the ecstasy of simply lying down. Jamie turned onto his side and gathered me against him, and we lay comfortably entwined, listening to the sounds of celebration outside. Quieter now, as people began to stagger home or find a peaceful tree or bush to sleep under. But the music of a single fiddle still sang to the stars. Chapter 129. The Pursuit of Happiness. It took William roughly 3 seconds to conclude that he meant to go after Amaranthus, and the rest of the day was a search for the means of her departure. He didn't know how long she'd been planning her disappearance. "Probably since I came back from Morristown," he thought grimly, "but she'd done a good job of it." He came home in the evening, having concocted a plan, if you could call it that, and proceeded to convince a very dubious uncle and father of its virtue over supper. Whether she went by horse, carriage, or ship, I think she must be heading for Charlestown. He hesitated, but there was no reason not to tell them. "When I mentioned Bannister Tarleton, when Charlestown fell, she remarked that she knew him, which I suppose means that he also knew or knows Ben."
"Did? Does?" Hal said, surprised. "Quite well, in fact. For a short time they were in the same company. Ban and Ben, people called them, you know, for a joke."
"Well then," William said with satisfaction, "Amaranthus knows that Ban is in Charlestown with Clinton. If she thought she needed help or protection on her way, would she not go to him?"
"It's a thought," said his father, though he looked dubious. "Clearly she didn't take much time to prepare."
"I don't know that she didn't," William said dryly. "She may have been planning it even before I came back, or thinking about it at least. Regardless of how she went, though, she can't have got that far yet. I may be able to overtake her on the road, and if by chance I don't, Ban may well have seen her, or contrived the next part of her passage. I don't imagine he knows yet. About Ben, I mean. If not, and if she told him she meant to go to Ben without saying exactly where he is, Ban would certainly help her." A brief stab of pain showed on Uncle Hal's face, but was brutally suppressed in the next moment.
"And what do you propose doing if you find her?"
he said, his voice rasping.
"Carry her back here by force?"
William lifted one shoulder, impatient.
"I'll find out what the devil she actually means to do, for one thing," he said. "She may be going to her father's house in Philadelphia, and if she is, I'll see that she gets there safely. If it's Ben..."
He paused, briefly recalling his harrowing escape from Morristown.
"I'll take her to Adam," he concluded. "He'll see that she's safe. And if she does mean to go to Ben..." "Jesus! Does Adam know?"
Hal's voice cracked and he coughed. William saw his father glance sharply at Hal and move toward a bell to summon a servant. Hal frowned at him and made a sharp gesture to stop him.
"I'm fine," he said shortly,
But the last word had to be forced out, and his breathing was suddenly stertorous.
"The devil you are,"
Papa said, and grabbed Uncle Hal by the elbow, hauling him to the sofa and pushing him down upon it.
"Willie, go and tell Moira to boil coffee, very strong, and lots of it, and now."
"I'm..."
Hal began, but broke off, coughing. He'd pressed his fist into his chest, and was turning a nasty colour that alarmed William.
"Is he?"
he began. His father turned on him like a tiger.
"Now!"
he shouted, and as William hurtled from the room, he heard his father call after him, "Get my saddlebags." The next few hours passed in a blur of activity, with people running to and fro and fetching things and making anxious, stupid suggestions, while Hal sat on the sofa, holding Papa's hand as though it were a rope thrown to a drowning swimmer, alternating between blowing air, gasping, and drinking black coffee with some sort of herb crumbled into it that Papa had dug out of his saddlebags. William, not knowing how to help, but unwilling to just go to bed, had lurked in the kitchen, carrying more hot coffee as needed, but mostly listening to Moira and Miss Crabbe, from whom he learned that the Duke suffered from something called asthma, and that, lowered voices with a cautious glance over the shoulder, Lord John's wife, but she wasn't really, and the things folks said of her, was a famous healer, and had given Lord John the little dry sticks to put in the coffee.
"And what his Grace will do if he has another of them fits on the boat?"
Moira said, shaking her head. "I don't know." "Boat?" asked William, looking up from his third piece of apple pie. "Is he meaning to go somewhere?"
"Oh, yes," Miss Crabbe said, nodding wisely. "To England?" "For to speak to the House of Lords," Moira added. "About the war," Miss Crabbe said quickly, before Moira could steal any more of her thunder.
William hid a smile in his napkin, but was curious. He wondered whether Uncle Hal really had opinions on the conduct of the war that he felt obliged to share with the House of Lords, or whether he had sought a good excuse to go home to England and Aunt Minnie.
He did know from his father that Hal hadn't been able to bring himself to write to his wife about Ben. "When does he mean to go?" he asked.
"In a month," Miss Crabbe said, and pursed her lips.
"Does Lord John mean to go as well?"
William half hoped the answer was no. While he didn't want Uncle Hal to choke to death alone on a ship, he much preferred to have Papa here, holding things together while he, William, pursued Amaranthus. The two women shook their heads, both looking grave. They might have said more, but at that moment Papa's quick footsteps came down the hall, and a moment later his dishevelled fair head poked through the door.
"He's better," he said at once, catching William's eye. "Come and help me. He wants to go up to his bed."
The Duke spent much of the next day in bed, but when William went up to check on his state of health, he was sitting upright, a writing desk on his knees, scribbling away. He looked up at William's advent and forestalled any queries by saying,
"So you still mean to go after her?"
It wasn't posed as a question, and William merely nodded. So did Hal, and took a clean sheet of paper from the choir on his bedside table.
"Tomorrow, then," he said.
At dawn of the next day, William fastened his stock, buttoned his buff waistcoat, pulled on the red coat he'd thought he'd never wear again, and went downstairs, his step firm in his freshly polished boots. His father and uncle were already at breakfast, and despite his impatience to be off, the smell of buttered cornbread, fried eggs, fresh ham, peach jam, crab fritters, and grilled sea trout was enough to make him sit down without argument. Both Papa and Uncle Hal viewed him with exactly the same look of mixed approval and veiled anxiety, making him want to laugh. But he didn't, instead inclining his head briefly. Neither one was talkative in the mornings, but apparently today was an exception.
"Here."
Uncle Hal pushed two folded documents with wax seals across the table to him.
"The red one's your commission, and the other's your orders, such as they are. I've given you the rank of captain, and your orders say you're to be given free passage essentially anywhere you want to go, without let or hindrance, and you may call upon the assistance of His Majesty's officers and troops as needed and available.
You think I might need a column of infantry to help drag Amaranthus back? William asked, biting into a warm slice of fresh buttered cornbread, thick with peach jam.
You think you won't? His father said, arching an eyebrow.
Lord John got up, and coming behind William, undid his hasty plait and rebraided it tight and neat before doubling it into a queue and binding it with his own black ribbon. The touch of his father's hands on his neck, warm and light, moved him. Everything this morning had a freshness about it and a sense of moment that made him feel he would recall every object seen or touched, every word spoken, for as long as he lived. He'd barely slept, his mind pulsing with energy, the stultification and petrifaction of the last month gone as though it had never existed. His statement that he was going after the girl had met with no opposition. Papa and Uncle Hal had exchanged a long glance, and then set to, making plans.
She said she'd made arrangements, Papa was saying, frowning over a forkful of sea trout. What sort of arrangements do you suppose? So far as any of the servants can tell, Hal replied, she made a raid on the pantry and absconded with enough food for 3 or 4 days, took her plainest clothes, and most of her jewellery, she...
Did she take her wedding ring? William interrupted.
Yes, Lord John said, and William shrugged. Then she's heading for Ben. She'd have left it if she was done with him.
Uncle Hal gave him the sort of look he would have given a performing flea who'd just turned a somersault, but Papa hid a smile behind his napkin.
We wouldn't let her go alone, even if we were positive that she is headed for her father's house, he said. A young woman alone on the road. And we do think she's alone, he added more slowly. Though I suppose it's possible that... More than possible, Uncle Hal said grimly. That young woman is your daughter-in-law, Lord John interrupted, and the mother of your heir. As such, we have every obligation to ensure her safety.
Mm-hmm.
William heard the grunt of agreement he'd made and stopped dead for an instant, a forkful of egg suspended, dripping yolk over his plate.
You probably don't want to hear this, but Da makes that sort of noise all the time.
He glanced swiftly from his father to his uncle, but neither of them seemed to have noticed anything odd in his response, and the party relapsed into a silent, steady engulfment of breakfast. William's new mare, Birdie, was happy to see him, and nosed him in search of apples, which he'd brought, and crunched them with evident pleasure, slobbering juice down his sleeve as he pulled the bridle over her ears. She sensed his own excitement, and pricked her ears and snorted a little, bobbing her head as he tightened the girth. He wondered just how Amaranthus had managed her vanishing act. None of the horses belonging to the household were missing. Not even the elderly mare Amaranthus was accustomed to ride. Either she'd taken a public coach, unlikely, he thought. Uncle Hal had probably sent directly to the coaching inn to have inquiries made, and she would have known he'd do that, or she'd hired a private carriage or a livery horse. Or she'd had help in absquatulating, and her bloody assistant had provided her transportation. He was running moodily through a list of local gallants that she might have seduced to her purposes, but was interrupted by the appearance of Lord John, with a purse in one hand and a small portmanteau in the other.
A plain suit, stockings, and a fresh shirt, he said briefly, handing over the latter, and money. There's a letter of credit in there as well. You might put that away in your pocket just in case.
In case I'm obliged to ransom her from a band of highwaymen? William asked, taking the purse. It was pleasantly heavy. He tucked it into his greatcoat, and taking one of the pistols from his saddlebag, tucked that into his belt.
Ha ha, said his father politely. William, if she is going to Ben, and she gets to him, don't. I repeat, don't make any effort to take her away from him. Next time, if there is a next time, he'll probably will kill you.
There was enough blunt finality in that opinion that decided William not to argue with it, though his pride thought strongly otherwise.
I won't,
he said briefly, and patted his father's shoulder, smiling. Don't worry about a thing.
Chapter 130. Herr Weber. A month passed the fall of Charlestown, and the place still looked like an anthill that someone had kicked over. All the citizens of the place appeared to be outside, carrying stones and lumber and baskets of dirt and buckets of paint, and those not occupied with cleaning and repair were shouting and selling meat and fruit, vegetables and poultry and hams, cockles and mussels, shrimps and oysters, and every other damn thing you could pull out of the sea and eat. The thought of eating, coinciding with the drifting smell of broiled fish, made William's mouth water. The seller of the savoury fish was unfortunately surrounded by a company of soldiers, all pushing for attention as the woman and her daughter shuffled small sizzling fish off hot bricks and into scraps of old newspaper as though they were dealing cards, while a small boy squatted beside them over a dented pot, taking coins from the soldiers and firing each one into the pot to make it ring. Not willing to draw attention to himself by using his captain's uniform to push his way into the mob, he turned toward the docks, where he'd certainly find food and doubtless drink as well at one of the numerous taverns. What he found, though, was Dennis Randall walking idly up and down a narrow quay, apparently waiting for someone.
"Ellesmere," Randall exclaimed, spotting him.
"Ransom," William corrected.
Dennis waved a hand, indicating that it was all one.
"Where have you sprung from?"
he asked, taking in William's uniform at a glance.
"And why?"
"I'm looking for Ban Tarleton. Seen him recently?"
Dennis shook his head, frowning.
"No, I suppose I could ask around there. Where are you staying?"
"Nowhere at the moment."
"Are there any decent places?"
He glanced round at a line of shirtless men gleaming with sweat as they moved baskets and barrows and wooden pallets of rubbish down to the shore.
What do they mean to do with all that? Build a seawall?
Or repair it, rather? There was an untidy ramble of fortifications outside the remains of the extant seawall, which had suffered much from the siege bombardments.
"They should do, but I dare say they'll just shove that lot into the water and be done with it. As to a sleeping place, try Mrs. Warren's on Broad Street."
Dennis picked up his hat and gave William a quick wave of the hand.
"I'll ask about Tarleton."
William nodded in acknowledgement and pushed off in search of Broad Street, Mrs. Warren, and food, not necessarily in that order. He found food quickly in the form of rice and red beans cooked with sausage at a stall near the parade ground. No troops were drilling, but as usual, with an army nearby, there were plenty of the civilians, sutlers, laundresses, food vendors, prostitutes, who fed off the army like a horde of voracious lice.
"Well, turnabout's fair play," he thought,
returning his bowl to the rice and beans proprietor for a second helping. Eating this one somewhat more slowly, he scanned the passing crowds for any trace of Amaranthus or Bannister Tarleton, but no trace did he see, and he thought he would instantly have perceived either one, both having a taste for vivid dress. Replete, he walked slowly round the city, up and down the major streets, peering into shops and banks and churches as he went. He had no idea whether either Amaranthus or Ban was religious. Somehow he doubted it. But the churches were cool, and it was good to sit down for a few moments and listen to the silence as a respite from the city's noise. He reached Mrs. Warren's house just before sunset, and after a very decent fish supper, went to bed, dog-tired, and low in spirit. These conditions were reversed in the morning, and he sprang from bed, with mind and body renewed, determined in spirit. He'd go first to Cornwallis's headquarters. He'd seen the house, with its regimental flags, on his peregrinations the evening before. Someone there would doubtless know at least where Bannister Tarleton was supposed to be. Someone did. The news, however, was not encouraging. Colonel Tarleton had taken a company of his British Legion southward 2 weeks before in pursuit of a body of fleeing American militia. A messenger had come back to report the outcome of a small but nasty fight near a place called Waxhaws. Tarleton's troops had overcome the Americans,
killing or injuring most of them and taking the rest prisoner. However, Colonel Tarleton had been injured by reason of his horse falling on him and had not yet returned to Charlestown. All right, that crossed Ban pretty definitely off William's list. Tarleton couldn't possibly have been lending Amarantha's aid in her escape. What next? The docks, of course. He'd begun searching there last night before his stomach had had other ideas. But if she was heading for Philadelphia, as she'd said, and had not taken a ship from Savannah, which she hadn't, he'd checked, then Charlestown was the next large port from which she might reasonably have done so. And surely a young woman travelling alone... God, was she alone? Might she have eloped with someone? Surely not. Would find ship travel safer, as well as more comfortable, than risking travel on roads swarming with soldiers, sappers, ex-slaves, and commercial wagons. It was a beautiful day, and he began his search with diligence, starting with the harbour master's office for a list of ships sailing within the last week for Philadelphia, or New York, just in case she's heading for Ben, and manifests for those who had posted them. Her name was not on any of the lists, but then he argued with himself she wouldn't necessarily be. If she'd sailed as a private passenger on a small boat, she wouldn't be listed anywhere. In the end, it came down to what he'd already known it would. A slog through the docks, on foot, asking questions of everyone he came across. After an hour of this, the beautiful day was beginning to dim as a fog bank moved in. He decided to slake his thirst, and began walking up the quay, a small one that docked fishing boats and smaller commercial ships, towards shore. What he found, though, was Dennis Randall, again. "Hoy," William said loudly, coming up behind Dennis and clapping him on the shoulder. "Do you live on the docks?"
"I might ask the same of you," Dennis said shortly,
and William now perceived that he wasn't alone. He was trying to shield a small man whose lined face made him look like a Christmas nutcracker, from William's view.
"Who are you looking for now?"
"A young woman," William said mildly.
"Who is your friend?"
Dennis was for once deprived of his air of light mockery and self-composure. William thought he presently resembled nothing more strongly than a cat on hot bricks. Dennis glanced swiftly at his companion, whose resemblance to a Christmas nutcracker was becoming more pronounced by the moment, then turned back to William, a pulse throbbing visibly at the side of his jaw.
"I must go and speak to someone," he said, quickly. "This is Herr Weber. Keep an eye on him. I'll be back as quick as I can."
And with that, he vanished down the quay toward the water, nearly running in his haste. William hesitated, not sure what to do. He was somewhat afraid that Dennis might have taken fright. Well, clearly he had. But fright at what? And abandoned his German companion altogether. In which case, what was he to do with the fellow? Weber was staring down at the planks of the quay, brow slightly furrowed. William cleared his throat.
"Would you care for a drink?"
he asked politely, and nodded toward an open-fronted shanty on the shore, where a couple of large barrels and the presence of a sailor lying on the ground insensible probably indicated an establishment that sold liquor.
"Ich spreche kein Englisch,"
the man said, spreading his hands in polite apology.
"Keine Sorge," William said, bowing. "Ich spreche Deutsch."
He might have informed Herr Weber that his britches were on fire, rather than making a simple statement to the effect that he, William, spoke German. Alarm convulsed the nutcracker's features, and he turned wildly, looking for Dennis, who had by now disappeared. William, afraid that Weber was about to flee, grasped him by the arm. This resulted in a sharp cry and a blow to William's stomach. Considering Weber's size, it wasn't a bad try, but William grunted at the impact, let go Weber's arm, grabbed the man by both shoulders, and shook him like a rat.
"Still," he said, "ich tue euch nichts."
The statement that he meant Weber no harm seemed not to soothe the gentleman, but the shaking at least stopped him struggling to get away. He went limp in William's grasp and stood gasping.
"What's going on?" William demanded sharply in German.
He nodded down the quay.
"Is that man keeping you prisoner?"
Weber shook his head.
"Nein.
ist mein Freund.
Well then. William let go and stepped back, hands spread in token of harmlessness.
Meiner auch.
Weber nodded warily and straightened his waistcoat, but declined further conversation, resuming his wooden impassiveness. A fine tremble passed through his person at intervals, but his face showed nothing, though he glanced now and then toward the deepening fog at the end of the quay. William could see shapes, mostly masts, that poked suddenly out of the mist as the air shifted, and the thick air carried random shouts that sounded eerily distant one moment and startlingly close at hand the next. The fog was deepening, creeping over the quay, and he had a sudden sense of disorientation, as though the world were dissolving under his feet. And then Dennis was suddenly there, with no warning. His face was still anxious, but bore a set resolution. He seized Weber's arm, glanced at William, and said briefly, "Comte." William wasted no time in argument, but seized the gentleman's other arm, and between them he and Dennis rushed the little man into the fog and up a gangplank that suddenly appeared in front of them. A tall man in a blue coat manifested himself on deck, flanked by two sailors. He looked closely at Dennis, nodded, then, catching a glimpse of William, started back as though he'd seen a demon.
"One soldier," he said sharply to Dennis, catching him by the sleeve. "One," they said. "Who's this?"
"I'm..." William began, but Dennis kicked him in the ankle.
"His friend," William said, nodding casually at Dennis. "There's no time for this," Dennis said.
He reached into his breast and withdrew a small, fat purse, which he handed over. The captain, for so he must be, William thought, hesitated for a moment, glanced suspiciously at him again, but took it. The next instant he was hurtling back down the gangplank, propelled by an urgent shove in the back from Dennis. He hit the quay, staggering, but regained his balance at once, and turned to see the ship. It looked like a small brig from what he could see through the mist, draw back the gangplank like a sucked-in tongue, cast off a final line, and with a rattle of shrouds and a snap of filling sails, move slowly away from the quay. In moments, it had disappeared into the greyness.
"What the devil just happened?" he asked, rather mildly, all things considered.
Dennis was breathing like he'd run a mile under arms, and the edge of his neckcloth was dark with sweat. He glanced over his shoulder to be sure that the ship had gone, and then turned back to William, his breath beginning to slow.
"Herr Weber has enemies," he said.
"So does everyone these days.
Who is Herr Weber?"
Dennis made a sound that might have been an attempt at a wry laugh.
"Well, he's not Herr Weber, for starters."
"Are you planning to tell me who he is?" William said impatiently. "Because I've got business elsewhere, if you haven't."
"Besides looking for a girl, you mean?"
"I mean supper.
You can tell me who our recent friend is on the way."
"He has a few aliases," Dennis said, halfway through a bowl of chowder thick with clams. "But his name is Haim Solomon. He's a Jew," he added.
"And?"
William had eaten his own chowder in nothing flat and was wiping the bowl with a chunk of bread. The name sounded vaguely familiar, but he couldn't think why it should.
"Solomon. Haim Solomon."
It was the word Jew that supplied the missing link of memory.
"Is he Polish, by chance?" he asked, and Dennis choked on a clam.
"Oh, he is."
William raised a hand toward the barmaid and pointed at his empty bowl with a gesture indicating that he'd like it refilled.
"How did he escape being executed in New York?"
Dennis coughed, gagged, and coughed explosively, scattering the tabletop with breadcrumbs, soup droplets, and a large chunk of clam. William rolled his eyes but reached for the beer pitcher and refilled their mugs. Dennis waited until the fresh chowder had been brought and his eyes had stopped watering, then leaned over his bowl, speaking in a voice barely loud enough to be heard, over the banging of canikins and blustering talk in the tap room.
"How in God's name did you come to know that?" he said.
William shrugged.
"Something my uncle said.
A Polish Jew. And he'd been condemned to death as a spy in New York. He was rather surprised to hear of him alive and here.
So, he added, taking a dainty spoonful of chowder,
if that's who your little friend is, and rather plainly he is, then I'm rather wondering just who, or rather what, you are these days. Because Herr Weber is plainly not in the employ of His Majesty.
Dennis drank the rest of his beer deliberately, brows knitted as he considered William.
I suppose it doesn't matter that you know. He's already out of reach, he said at last.
He belched slightly, said, excuse me, and poured more beer while William waited patiently.
Mr. Salomon is a banker, Dennis said, and having evidently made up his mind to tell William more or less the truth, went on. Born in Poland, Salomon had come to New York as a young man and made a successful career. He had also begun to meddle, very cautiously, in revolutionary politics, arranging various financial transactions for the benefit of the new Congress and the emergent revolution. But he wasn't as cautious as he thought. And the British did catch him, and he was indeed condemned to death. But then he got a pardon, though they put him on a hulk in the Hudson and made him teach English to Hessian soldiers for 18 months.
He took another gulp of beer.
Little did they know that he was urging them all to desert, which a good number of them actually did, apparently.
I know, William said dryly. A group of Hessian deserters had tried to kill him during Monmouth and come bloody close to doing so, too. If his wretched Scottish cousin hadn't found him in the bottom of a ravine with his skull cracked. But no need to dwell on that. Not now.
Persistent fellow, then, he said. So now he's here, and as there don't seem to be any Hessians around to be traduced, I assume he's gone back to his financial tricks.
So far as I know, Dennis said, now all nonchalance.
Good friend of General Washington's, I hear.
Good for him, William said shortly. And what about you? As you're sitting here telling me all this, am I to assume that you also are now a personal chum of Mr. Washington's? William was, in fact, not really surprised to be hearing these things. Dennis drew out a handkerchief and patted his lips delicately.
Not me, so much as my stepfather, he said. Mr. Isaacs is a good friend of Mr. Salomon's and shares both his political sentiments and his financial acumen.
Is? William said, raising his eyebrows.
Didn't you tell me that your stepfather had died, and that's why you dropped the Isaacs from your last name?
Did I? Dennis looked thoughtful.
Well, a good many people believe he's dead. Let's put it that way. It's often easier to get certain things done if people don't know exactly who they're dealing with. The fact that he, William, plainly didn't know whom he'd been dealing with was becoming painfully obvious. So, you're a turncoat, but you haven't bothered actually taking it off and turning it inside out, is that it?
I think the actual term might be intrigante, William, but what's in a word?
I began working with my stepfather when I was 15 or so, learning my way around the worlds of finance and politics. Both those threads weave through war, you know, and war is expensive. And sometimes profitable.
Something that might be offence rippled under Dennis's placid expression, but vanished in a small gesture of dignified dismissal.
My real father was a soldier, you know. And he left me a comfortable sum of money with a stipulation that I should use it to buy a commission, if I should turn out to be a boy, that is. He died before I was born.
And if you'd been a girl? William began suddenly to wonder whether Dennis might have a loaded pistol in his lap under the table.
The money would have been my marriage portion, and doubtless I'd now be the wife of some rich, boring merchant who beat me once a week, fucked me once a month, and otherwise left me to my own devices.
Despite his wariness, William laughed.
My mother wanted me to be a clergyman, poor woman, Dennis shrugged. As it is, though.
Yes. William's calves tightened. His left hand was under the table, still holding the spoon from his chowder, the handle jutting out between the clenched fingers of his fist. It wasn't the weapon he'd have chosen,
but if necessary, he was prepared to jam it up Dennis's nose. A conversation like this could have only one end, to invite William to join Dennis in his intrigue. He was halfway amused at the situation, also somewhat annoyed, but cautious with it. If Dennis did issue such an invitation, and if William refused point blank, Dennis might consider it dangerous to leave William at large to repeat all this.
Well, Dennis eyed his uniform, you did tell me you'd resigned your commission.
I did. This, he waved his free hand down the front of his red coat, is just to give me countenance and safe passage while I look for my cousin's wife.
Dennis's eyes widened.
This is the girl you're after. Is she lost?
I notice that you don't ask which cousin.
No, she's not lost. She had a falling out with her husband, to say the least, and decided to go to her father's house. But my uncle became concerned about her safety on the road and sent me to see that she reached her destination safely. I thought that if she passed through Charlestown, which she likely would, she might call upon Ban Tarleton for any assistance. She and her husband are acquainted with him.
Unfortunately, Major Tarleton isn't in Charlestown.
The voice spoke behind him, an English voice that his body recognized before his mind did, and he turned round fast, spoon clenched hard.
Good day, Captain Lord Ellesmere, said Ezekiel Richardson.
He glanced indifferently at the spoon and bowed slightly.
I trust you'll pardon the interruption, gentlemen. I happen to overhear Major Tarleton's name. He and Major Ferguson are, in fact, in hot pursuit of several groups of retreating American militia running south.
William hesitated for a moment, torn between curiosity, leavened by indignation, and expedience. But it was an instant too long. Richardson pulled up a stool and sat down at the small round table between William and Dennis. Well within grabbing, or shooting or stabbing, for that matter, distance.
Has Herr Weber left us in good order?
Richardson asked, presumably of Dennis, but his eyes were fixed on William.
Rather jumpy, Dennis said, but quite intact. Our friend William was most helpful in keeping him from jumping off the dock and swimming home whilst I went and made the final arrangements.
We're most obliged to you, Lord Ellesmere.
My name is Ransom, sir.
The sparse eyebrows rose.
Indeed.
Richardson, who was not in uniform, but wearing a decent grey suit, darted a quick glance at Dennis, who shrugged slightly.
I think so, he said obliquely.
If what you think is that I will choose to join you in your treasonous games, gentlemen, William said, pushing back from the table, I must disabuse you of the notion. Good day.
Not so fast. Richardson said, clamping a hand on William's forearm. If you please, my lord.
There was a slight mocking inflection to that my lord, or at least that's how it sounded to William, who was in no mood for trifling.
No commission, no rank, and not my lord. Be so kind as to remove your hand, sir, or I shall remove it for you.
William made a slight gesture with his spoon, which was flimsy, but made of tin, and whose handle came to a triangular point. Richardson paused, and William's muscles tightened. The hand lifted, though, just in time.
I suggest you consider Dennis's suggestion, Richardson said, his tone light. Resigning your commission has doubtless caused some gossip in army circles, and if you are declining to be addressed by your title, it will cause more. I do think, though, that you might hesitate to cause the sort of gossip that will be unleashed if the reason behind your actions were to be made public.
You know nothing of my reason, sir.
William stood up, and so did Richardson. We know that you are the bastard son of one James Fraser, a Jacobite traitor and present rebel, he said pleasantly. And one look at the two of you, drawn side by side in the newspapers, would be enough to convince anyone of the truth.
William uttered a short laugh, though it came out as a hoarse bark.
You say what you like, sir, to whomever it pleases you to say it.
Go to the devil.
And with that, he stabbed the spoon, handle first, into the table and turned to walk away. Behind him, Richardson spoke,
his voice still pleasant.
"I know your sister," he said.
William's shoulders tensed, but he kept on walking until the docks of Charlestown lay far behind. Chapter 131. Thunderstorms on the Ridge. July the 4th, Anno Domini, 1780.
To Colonel James Fraser, Fraser's Ridge, from John Sevier. Mr. Fraser, I write first to thank you for the gift of your most excellent whisky. I had occasion to visit Mrs. Patton recently and shared with her a small bottle that I had upon my person. Judging from her demeanour, I believe your custom will be welcome at her mill at any time you wish, provided you come armed with the right sort of currency. I write also to tell you that Nicodemus Partland, while inadvertently responsible for my enjoyment of your whisky, is otherwise no gift to a liberal society. Mr. Cleveland, in his capacity as constable, imprisoned Mr. Partland and three of his companions on charges of disturbing the peace. He kept them for 3 weeks in his barn and then released them separately, one each week for the succeeding 3 weeks, thus ensuring that Mr. Partland would not be greeted by a large group of followers upon his eventual reappearance. I have kept an ear out, but have heard nothing of any new effort to raise a party of aggression, for I will not call such a body a committee of safety, as the term is often much abused, near the treaty line. If the Cherokee lands lie quiet, other places do not. I have had word of a Major Patrick Ferguson, who, in the midst of the siege of Charlestown, was sent to the south with Major Tarleton, for I know you are familiar with this gentleman's name, and his loyalist British Legion, whence they ousted an American force at Monk's Corner near Charlestown. You had asked me if I knew of Major Ferguson, and now I do. I shall watch out for any further news of him. Your obedient servant, John Sevier.
July the 10th, 1780. There had been thunderstorms on the mountain all week, and the day had begun with a brief rattle of rain against the shutters an hour or so before dawn, and a blast of cold wind that shot down the chimney hit the smoured embers and spewed hot ashes all over the bedroom floor. Jamie leapt out of bed and sloshed water from the ewer across the hearthrug, stamping out stray sparks with his bare feet and muttering sleepy execrations in Gaelic. He poked up the remaining embers, stuffed a couple of chunks of fat pine and a longer-burning hickory log in among them with a bit of fresh kindling, and stood there in his shirt, arms folded tight against the chill of the room, waiting to be sure the fresh wood had caught. Still snug in bed, I blinked drowsily, appreciating the sight of him. The rising light of the new fire glowed behind him and flickered on the stones of the mantel, making the shadow of his long body visible through the linen. The touch of that body was still vividly imprinted on my skin, and I began to feel somewhat less sleepy. When he was sure the new fire was well underway, he nodded and muttered something, whether to himself or the fire, I couldn't tell. There were Highland fire charms, and he undoubtedly knew a few. Satisfied, he turned, crawled back into bed, wrapped his long, cold limbs around me, sighing as he relaxed into my warmth, farted, and went blissfully back to sleep. By the time I woke up again, he was gone, and the room was warm and smelled pleasantly of the ghosts of turpentine and fire. I could hear the wind whining round the corners of the house, though, and the creak of the new timbers and laugh of the third-floor walls just above us. Another storm was coming. I could smell the sharp scent of ozone in the air. Fanny and Agnes were up. I could hear the muffled sound of their voices down in the kitchen, amid heartening sounds of breakfast being made. Agnes had agreed, with a mixture of trepidation and excitement, to go to Charlestown with the Cunninghams, and then to London, by which time she would theoretically have made up her mind as to which of the two lieutenants would be her husband. The captain had survived, but had had a setback that delayed their departure. He had rallied, but was still in fragile health,
and Jamie had told him that he was welcome to stay until the roads were safer. There was no chance of his riding. His legs were still paralyzed, though he did have sensations in his feet, and I thought I had seen a faint twitch of his left toe. Sylvia and the girls were up too, though only a faint murmur of voices reached me from the heights of the third floor. Jamie had considered giving them one of the loyalists' forfeited cabins, but he, Jenny, and Ian had all thought it might be bad luck for Quakers to inherit the spoils of war, as it were. He, Ian, and Roger would build them a new cabin before the winter came. As for me, I was more than happy to have three more females able to cook on the premises, though the Hardmans' expertise didn't extend to much beyond roasting potatoes and making stews. I wasn't picky. I was still reveling in the novelty of having several someone else's who would deal with the constant juggling act of turning food into meals, to say nothing of helping with things like soap and candle making, and laundry. Roger and Bree had gone to Salem with the wagon to trade for pottery and woven cloth. Bree hadn't yet had time or space to begin building a loom, but there were plenty of willing hands available for the domestic chores. I splashed my face with cold water, brushed my teeth, and got dressed, feeling more alert as I started planning the day. Jamie hadn't gone hunting this morning. I could hear his voice downstairs exchanging pleasantries with the girls. If he meant to spend the day at home, perhaps I could induce him to retire with me for a short rest after lunch. How did he do that? I wondered. How could just the sound of his voice, no words, just a soft rumble, make me recall the warm dark of our pre-dawn bed? I was still thinking about it in a vague sort of way when I reached the kitchen to find him licking the last drops of milk off his spoon. How dissipated of you, I said, sitting down opposite him with a small pot of honey and half a loaf from the pie safe. Milk on your porridge? Most Highland Scots turned up their long noses at such indulgence, preferring the stern virtue of oatmeal unadorned by anything more than a pinch of salt. Jenny would disown you.
Likely, he said, undaunted at the prospect. But we Ban and Ruai both in calf, we've milk to spare, and it wouldn't be right to let it go to waste now, aye? Is that honey?
His eyes had focused on the honey pot as soon as I set it down. I broke off a small chunk of bread, carefully spread a dab of the pale honey onto it, and handed it to him. Taste that. Not like that, I said, seeing him about to engulf the bite. He froze, the bread halfway to his mouth.
How am I meant to taste it if I'm not to put it in my mouth? He asked warily. Have you thought of some novel method of ingestion?
Fanny giggled behind me. Agnes, setting a platter of fried bacon at his elbow, squinted at ingestion but didn't say anything. He lifted the morsel to his nose and sniffed it cautiously. Slowly. You're meant to savour it, I added reprovingly. It's special.
Oh.
He closed his eyes and inhaled deeply.
Well, it's got a fine light nose.
He raised his eyebrows, eyes still closed.
And a nice bouquet, to be sure. Lily of the valley, burnt sugar, something a wee bit bitter, maybe.
He frowned, concentrating, then opened his eyes and looked at me.
Bee dung?
I made a grab for the bread, but he snatched it away, stuffed it in his mouth, closed his eyes again, and assumed an expression of rapture as he chewed. See if I ever give you any more sourwood honey, I said. I've been saving that. He swallowed, blinked, and licked his lips thoughtfully.
Sourwood? Is that no what you gave Bobby Higgins last week to make him shit?
That's the leaves. I waved at a tall jar on top of the Simples cabinet. Sarah Ferguson says that sourwood honey is monstrously good and monstrously rare, and that the folk in Salem and Cross Creek will give you a small ham for a jar of it. I sent some with Bree.
Will they so?
He eyed the honey pot with more respect.
And it's from your own wee stingards, is it?
Yes, but the sourwood trees only bloom for about 6 weeks, and I've only the two hives set near them so far. I took this as soon as the trees stopped blooming. That's why it's so.
A thunder of feet coming onto the porch and in the front door drowned me out, and the air was filled with excited boys' voices shouting, "Grandpa! Avister! Mr. Freezer!" Jamie stuck his head out into the corridor.
"What?"
he said, and the running feet stumbled to a ragged halt in a storm of exclamations and pantings, in the midst of which I picked out one word. Redcoats. Jamie didn't wait to hear more. He got up, pushed the boys out of the way, and headed for the front door. I ran into the surgery, snatched a big curved amputation knife from the cupboard, and rushed after Jamie and the boys. Jem, Aidan, and two friends were still panting and explaining in a confused gabble.
"There's two of them. No, there's three. But t'other one, he's not a soldier. He's a black man, Avister."
"A black man? That would be nothing notable anywhere in the Carolinas, save in the high mountains. There were a few free blacks in Brownsville and small settlements that included people of mixed blood. But a black man in a red coat?" Jamie had left his rifle standing beside the door the day before and now grabbed it, his face set and wary.
"Besucher," he said briefly to the boys. "Go to the kitchen, but stay inside and keep your lugs open. You hear any kind of a stramash, take the women out the back and put them up a tree. Then go fetch your father's, quick."
The boys nodded, breathless, and I pushed past them with a brief look strongly suggesting that they best not even think of trying to haul me out the back door and shove me up a tree, no matter what happened. They all looked shifty, but hung their heads. Jamie yanked the door open, and cold air whooshed down the hall, whipping my petticoats up in a froth round my knees. The men, three of them on horseback, were riding slowly up the rise, toward the house. And, just as the boys had said, all three were red-coated British soldiers, and the third, the man in the lead, was indeed a black man. In fact, they all were. I saw Jamie glance round at the woods and surrounding landscape. Were they alone? I peered anxiously past his elbow, but couldn't see or sense anything amiss. Neither did he. His shoulders relaxed slightly, and he checked his rifle to be sure it was primed. It was always kept loaded, and set it carefully back behind the door, then stepped out onto the porch. I wasn't letting go of my knife, but did hide it in the folds of my skirt. The oncoming men saw us on the porch. The leader checked his horse for a moment, then raised a hand to us. Jamie raised a hand in reply, and they came on. Dozens of possible reasons for such a visitation were darting through my head, but at least they didn't look overtly threatening. The leader halted by our hitching post, swung down, and dropped his reins, leaving his horse to the other soldiers, who remained mounted. That was vaguely reassuring. Perhaps they'd only come to ask directions. So far as I knew, and devoutly hoped, the British Army had no present business with us. Plainly, this wasn't Major Patrick Ferguson. I had an odd feeling between my shoulder blades, though. Not fright, but something uneasy. Something seemed very familiar about this man. I felt Jamie take a deep breath and let it out again carefully.
"I bid you welcome, sir," he said,
his voice pleasant but neutral.
"You'll pardon my not using your surname. I never kent what it was."
"Stevens," said our visitor, and taking off his laced hat, bowed to me.
"Captain Joseph Stevens, your servant, Mrs. Fraser, and yours, sir," he added, in a distinctly ironic tone that made me blink.
He was wearing a military wig, and suddenly I saw him as I'd known him before, in a neat white wig and green livery, at River Run Plantation.
"Ulysses," I said,
and dropped the knife with a loud thunk. Jamie invited Captain Stevens to come in, with a sort of exquisite courtesy that meant he was doing a mental rundown of the location of all weapons inside the house. I saw him usher Ulysses before him to the laird's study, and glanced at the rifle that was standing behind the front door as he followed, nodding to the round-eyed boys and an equally round-eyed Fanny who had appeared from the spring house as he went.
"Fanny," I said, "go to the kitchen, please,
and get a pitcher of milk and a plate of biscuits?
We ate all the biscuits for breakfast, ma'am,
Fanny said helpfully.
There's half a pie in the pie safe, though.
Thank you, sweetheart. You and Agnes take the pie and milk out to the two men on the porch, please. Oh, Aidan, take this back to my surgery, will you? I handed him the amputation knife, which he received as one being given Excalibur, and bore it off, gingerly balanced across his palms. I slipped into the study and closed the door behind me. I'd last seen Ulysses at River Run Plantation, near Cross Creek, where he had been butler to Jamie's aunt Jocasta. He had left under what might politely be called strained circumstances, it having been revealed that he'd been not only Jocasta's butler for 20 years, but also her lover, and had killed at least one man and, just possibly, Hector Cameron, Jocasta's third husband. I didn't know what he'd been doing for the last 7 or 8 years, but the fact that he'd come anywhere near Jamie now, and accompanied by an armed escort, was deeply unsettling.
Mrs. Fraser?
He turned when I came in, and now bowed to me, looking me over with a deliberately appraising, unbutler-like gaze.
I'm pleased to see you well.
Thank you. You're looking quite well yourself, Captain Stevens. He was. Tall and imposing, in a well-tailored uniform, broad-shouldered and fit. Despite his apparent health, though, his face showed the marks of hard living, and his eyes were different. No longer the courteous blankness of a servant. These eyes were deep-lined, fierce, and quite frankly made me want to take a step backward. He saw that, and his lips drew in a little in amusement, but he looked away. Jamie was reaching into his cupboard for whiskey. He nodded Ulysses to the visitor's chair across the desk and set the battered pewter tray with bottle and glasses on the desk before taking his own chair. May I said, and at Ulysses' nod I poured him a respectable dram and the same for Jamie. And for me. I wasn't going anywhere until I found out what Captain Stevens was doing here. I took my glass and sat down on the stool, a little behind Jamie.
Flanger.
Jamie lifted his glass briefly, and Ulysses smiled slightly.
Flanger, va,
he said.
You'll have kept your Gaelic, then,
Jamie said, a deliberate reference, I thought, to River Run, where most of the servants had had at least a passing acquaintance with the language of the Highlands.
Not surprising,
Ulysses replied, not at all discomposed. He took a sip of the whiskey, paused to let it spread through his mouth, and shook his head with a small of approval.
I joined Lord Dunmore's company in 74. You'll know his lordship, of course.
Jamie stiffened slightly.
I do,
he said politely,
though I've not had the pleasure of his acquaintance since the days before Culloden.
What? I said. I don't recall a Lord Dunmore.
Well, he hadn't got the title then.
Jamie glanced back at me and smiled a little, a rueful sharing of the memory of those fraught days.
But you kent him too, Sassenach. John Murray he was then, just the lad, a page to Charles Stuart.
Oh, yes. I did recall him, just barely. A homely boy with receding chin, a large nose, and red hair that stuck out in tufts. So, now he's Lord Dunmore.
Yes. Of late, governor of the colony of Virginia, Ulysses said, and more recently, commander of a major force against the Shawnee Indians in Ohio, a successful venture in which I was privileged to take part.
He did smile then, and I felt a small qualm in the pit of my stomach at the look of it. Indian wars were a messy business.
Aye, Jamie said dismissively. But surely the army has nae business of that kind with the Cherokee? Though perhaps you've come with their allowance of powder and bullets from the government. I have no army business with the Cherokee, no,
Ulysses replied politely.
In fact, I think of retiring from the army soon. Perhaps I shall follow your example, Mr. Fraser, and set up for a landlord. But for the moment, sir, my business is with you, though this visit is a personal one rather than an official call, as yet. A personal visit?
Jamie repeated, and leaned back a little in his chair, tilting his head.
And what might your personal business be with me? Your aunt,
Ulysses said, and leaned forward, eyes fixed on Jamie's face.
Does she still live?
I was taken aback, but at the same time realized that I wasn't really surprised at all. Neither was Jamie, who didn't change his expression but took a long, slow breath before replying.
She does, he said, though I cannot tell you a great deal more than that.
Ulysses' expression had certainly changed. His face was vivid, charged with urgency.
You can tell me where she is?
I couldn't always tell what Jamie was thinking, but in this instance I was reasonably sure we were thinking the same thing. Jocasta had married one of Jamie's friends, Duncan Innes, while still carrying on her long-term affair with Ulysses, as we learned much later. In the chaotic aftermath of events at River Run and the subsequent dramatic revelations, Ulysses had fled, Jocasta had sold River Run, and she and Duncan had moved to Nova Scotia, and thence to a small farm on St. John's Island. I knew that the British Army offered freedom to slaves who would join their ranks, and obviously that was the path Ulysses had chosen with Lord Dunmore. Jocasta had secretly manumitted him years before, but officially recognized freedom was a much safer path, especially in North Carolina, where a slave freed by his or her master must leave the colony within 10 days, or be subject to recapture and sale. So now he was a free man, by the goodwill of the British government, completely and permanently free, so long as he wasn't captured by Americans with other ideas. While that knowledge made me happy for him, I had a great many reservations. Behind the bland mask of servitude, this man had lived for 20 years as the unknown master of River Run, and had killed without compunction. He had, very plainly, loved Jocasta Cameron passionately, and she him. And now he had come looking for her again. Very romantic. And very unsettling. I recalled vividly the skeletal remains of Daniel Rawlings sprawled on the floor of the mausoleum at River Run, and a ripple of goose flesh ran up my back. I glanced quickly at Jamie, who carefully didn't look at me. He sighed, rubbed a hand over his face, then dropped it, meeting Ulysses' eyes.
"I have not heard from my aunt any time these 5 years past," he said, "and have heard little more about her save that she is still alive, and well. Or at least she was, when I heard it from my cousin Hamish when I met him at Saratoga. That will be 3 years past, and that's the last I've heard."
All of that was mostly true. On the other hand, we did know a bit more than that, as Jocasta now and then wrote to her old friend Farquhar Campbell, who lived in Cross Creek. But I could see why Jamie didn't mean to set Captain Ulysses Stevens on a dangerous path toward an unwarned and literally unarmed, the poor man had only one, Duncan Innes. Ulysses looked hard into Jamie's eyes for a long minute. I could hear the ticking of Jenny's tiny silver watch on the shelf behind me. She'd left it when she'd come down to lend a hand with combing and carding several fleeces the week before. At last, Ulysses gave a small grunt, which might have been either amusement or disgust, and sat back.
"I thought it might be like that," he said mildly. I'm sorry not to have a better answer for you, Captain."
Jamie pushed back his chair and made to rise, but Ulysses raised a pink-palmed hand to stop him.
"Not so fast, Mr. Fraser. Or no, I beg your pardon, it's General Fraser now, is it not?"
"No, it's not," Jamie replied shortly. "I resigned my commission in the Continental Army, and I've no connection with it any more."
Ulysses nodded, urbane as always.
"Of course, forgive me. But there are some things harder to renounce than a commission, are there not?"
"If you've more to say," Jamie said, an edge in his voice, "say it, then go with God. There's nothing for you here."
Ulysses' smile showed a missing premolar on one side and a grey dead tooth beside it.
"I do apologize, Mr. Fraser, but I think you'll find you're mistaken. I do have business here. With you."
I let my breath out, then lost it altogether when he reached into his coat and produced a very official-looking document sealed with red wax. Red wax, in my experience, was usually a bad sign.
"Read that, sir, if you will,"
Ulysses said, and unfolding it, placed it carefully on the desk in front of Jamie. Jamie raised his brows and looked at Ulysses for a moment, but then picked up the letter with a shrug and popped the seal off with the tip of the skinning knife he used as a letter opener. His spectacles were sitting on the desk, and he put them on with deliberate slowness, smoothing out the creases in the letter. I could hear voices in the house. The girls had come back from the spring house with the cheese for supper and the crock of butter we'd need for tomorrow's baking. I caught a whiff of raspberries as Fanny's footsteps passed the door, and the soft clank of her tin bucket brushing the wall as she turned to call to Agnes. We'd make a fresh pie then, if the berries survived a kitchen full of hungry boys. Jamie said something very terrible in Gaelic, took off his spectacles, and gave Ulysses a look meant to set his wig on fire. I plunged a hand into my pocket for my own spectacles and took the letter from him. It was sent from one Lord George Germain, Secretary of State for the American Department. I'd heard quite a bit about Lord George Germain. John Gray had worked under him briefly as a diplomat and held a low opinion of the man, but that didn't matter just now. What did matter was that it had come to the attention of Lord George Germain, Secretary of State, etc., that one James Fraser, known erstwhile in Scotland as Lord Brochturach, a convicted and pardoned Jacobite, had, in the year of our Lord, 1767, fraudulently obtained a grant of land in the colony of North Carolina by misrepresenting and disguising to Governor William Tryon his identity as a Catholic, such persons being prohibited by law from holding such grants.
I felt as though I were being suffocated.
It was true. Not that Jamie had misrepresented himself to Governor Tryon. The governor had known all about Jamie's Catholicism, but had turned a deliberately blind eye to it for the sake of getting Jamie's help in settling, in more ways than one, the tumultuous North Carolina backcountry during the War of the Regulation. But it was undeniably true that Catholics were by law not allowed to receive land grants. And so, I forced a breath and read on. There being at present no duly appointed governor for the colony of North Carolina, the Secretary of State for the colonies now orders the aforesaid James Fraser to surrender the grant of lands thus fraudulently obtained to Captain Ulysses Stevens, of His Majesty's Company of Black Pioneers, acting as agents of the Crown, and vacate the premises of the grant, location and dimensions being described in the attached document. Any tenants presently living on the grant may remain for the space of 1 year. After such time, tenants must leave or make arrangements to deliver rent as may be determined by the new holder of this grant. The words blurred into spots before my eyes, and I dropped the letter back on the desk. "You bloody reptile," I said, looking at Ulysses. He ignored me.
"I would take prompt notice of that if I were you, Mr. Fraser."
He nodded at the paper.
"You see, there is no mention of prosecution, of fines or imprisonment. There might have been. I have the original agreement signed by you, in the course of which it is stated that you are not a Catholic, and should you choose to ignore—"
The door opened and Fanny's neat capped head poked in.
"Sir, Agnes says, are these men staying for supper?"
There was a moment of profound silence, and then Jamie rose slowly to his feet.
"They are not, Olenin. Go and see, so I."
He waited, still standing, until the door had closed again. I was now breathing so fast that white spots showed at the edge of my vision, but I saw his face very clearly.
"Leave my house," he said quietly, "and do not come back."
Ulysses stayed where he was, a faint smile on his face, and then rose too, very slowly.
"As I was saying, sir, I should obey that order promptly,
for if you choose to ignore it, the army will have more than sufficient justification to come and burn this house over your head."
He paused and turned to look deliberately at the door where Fanny had vanished.
"Over all your heads."
Jamie made a quick movement, and Ulysses flinched, much to my pleasure. But Jamie had merely snatched the official letter from the desk. He crumpled it into a ball, and turning, hurled it into the hearth. Then turned again on Ulysses with an expression that made the man stiffen. He didn't speak. Ulysses stooped swiftly and plucked the letter out of the smouldering ashes, shook it clean, then turned on his heel and went, back straight to the butler, carrying a tray. Jamie sat down slowly and set his hands very precisely on the desk in front of him, palms on the wood, ready to launch him into action, as soon as he decided what action to take. There actually was an acting governor of North Carolina, Richard Caswell, whom we knew fairly well. He was not, though, a governor appointed by the British government. He'd been temporarily elected by the Committee of Safety, appointed by the Provincial Congress, both of these rather fluid entities, but neither of them legitimate, so far as Lord George Germain was concerned. "They can't really," I began, but stopped. They could, all too easily, and I swallowed, my skin prickling with sudden fear. The smell of fresh sawdust and oozing pitch had come in the front door with a gust of wind from the spot by the red cedar tree, where the men cut shims and adzed shingles for the roof. Wood. No one who's lived through a house fire hears the word burn with any sense of equanimity, and I wasn't feeling even slightly equanimous. Neither was Jamie. "I don't suppose it's a forgery," I said at last. "That letter?" He shook his head.
"I've seen enough official documents to ken the seals, Sassenach."
"Do you think he's responsible for it? Did he sick the government onto us? Could he?" Jamie's brows went up and he glanced at me.
"I imagine a good many folk knew about it, but I doubt most of them have anything against me, and even fewer would be able to get the secretary's attention for such a wee matter."
"Lord Dunmore, perhaps?" I suggested delicately. "He certainly wouldn't care, but if he felt that he owed Ulysses something..." The blood was rising in Jamie's face, and his left hand folded into a fist.
"What was it the Black Hair said? That he thought of becoming a landlord himself?"
"Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ." I looked hard at the battered surface of the desk as though the gaudy letter was still there. "And he said he has the original document, not the government or Lord Germain. Him." The British government was, in fact, in the habit of confiscating rebel property and bestowing it on their own lackeys. They'd done it all over the Highlands after Culloden. And Jamie had saved Lallybroch only by deeding it to his 10-year-old nephew before Culloden. A moment's silence.
"Do I think he has more than those two men with him?" he asked.
But he wasn't asking me, and immediately answered his own question.
"Aye, I do. How many? That's the question."
Whatever the answer was, it propelled him to his feet, a look of decision on his face, with an underlying layer of intent ferocity that I had no trouble in distinguishing. I felt much the same, shock and fear fading into fury. "That bastard," I said. He didn't reply, but thrust his head out into the hall and bellowed, "Aidan," in the direction of the kitchen. Bobby Higgins turned up first, his pale face flushed with alarm and excitement. He wasn't a good horseman, but could ride well enough on an open trail, and since the bear, he had resumed carrying a musket.
"Ian will be coming down quick as he can," Jamie told him, hastily saddling and bridling Phineas, the fastest of our three saddle horses. "And I've sent the lads to carry word to the Lindsays, Gilly Macmillan, and the McHughes. They'll spread the word further, but they'll come on here by themselves. You come with me. And when we're sure of the track, I'll send you back here to tell the others and lead them on to join me, aye?"
"Yes, sir."
Bobby said it by reflex, straightening his back. "Once a soldier, always a soldier.
Jamie clapped him on the shoulder and put his own foot in the stirrup.
Away, then.
He blessed whoever was in charge of the weather, be that saint or demon, for the rain held off, and it was no trick to follow the trail of Ulysses and his two men on the muddy ground. It shortly became evident that there were more than two men with Ulysses. Jamie and Bobby came upon a spot nay more than a mile from the house, where the marks in the churned-up mud made it clear that Ulysses had joined a band of 20 men at least, maybe more.
"Go back to the house,"
he shouted to Bobby, and waved a hand, encompassing the small clearing.
"Tell Ian to bring as many men here as he can, and leave word for the rest. A blind man could follow this lot."
Bobby nodded, pulled down his hat, and set off uphill, leaning perilously back in his saddle, reins clutched to his chest. Jamie grimaced, but waved reassuringly when Bobby looked back over his shoulder. He only needed to stay on the horse as far as the house.
"Even if he falls off and breaks his neck," he muttered to himself, reining round, "they can follow our track this far, if it doesn't pour."
He looked upward into a dizzying swirl of black clouds and saw the flash of silent lightning. He counted 10 before the roll of distant thunder reached him.
"Onward,"
he said to Finn, and they set off downhill, following the black hoofprints still showing clear. The mounted band was moving briskly, but not fleeing, and while there were sprinkles of rain on his face, the storm had not yet broken. Jamie kept well back, always with an ear behind him for his own men coming. And come they did, to his unspoken but vast relief. He heard them, and reined uphill to meet them out of earshot of the troops he was following. He supposed they must be regular British troops, for Ulysses wouldn't go through the mummery of pretending to be a British soldier if he weren't one. If they were, though, he'd have to go canny. He wasn't wanting a physical fight. His infant militia weren't up to taking on trained soldiers yet. The back of his mind had been keeping its peace to this point, but now it took the opportunity of his relaxed vigilance to ask him just what the devil he did want. He wanted to get Ulysses alone, with a dirk in his hand and 5 minutes to use it. But failing that, he wanted to catch up to the man and go through his saddlebags, both for that damned letter — why had he not been quick enough to stop the man taking it — and for the original grant, should Ulysses be carrying it. Which meant cutting him out of his own companions and sequestering him somewhere briefly. He would have given the rest of the fingers on his right hand to have young Ian with him now, but he didn't dare wait. He crossed himself with a quick prayer to St. Michael and threaded his horse carefully through a clump of spruce. Emerging on the far side, he saw the flash of a horse's flank and heard the jingle of harness.
"Throw it ashore. Over here."
It wasn't raining yet, but the air still held that strange muffled quality, and he felt as though he'd shouted through a pillow. They heard him, though, and within a minute or two they were on their way.
"Who is it we're after, sir?"
asked Anson McHugh politely. The eldest of Tom McHugh's sons, he'd come with his father and a younger brother, as well as the Lindsay brothers, and a few others who lived close enough to get the summons in time.
"A band of black British soldiers,"
Jamie told them.
"Black soldiers?"
Anson asked, looking puzzled. "Is there such a thing, then?"
"There is,"
Jamie assured him dryly.
"Lord Dunmore. You ken Lord Dunmore?" "Oh, you don't. Nae matter, he started it some years back by getting into a moil wi' the Virginians he was meant to be governing. They wouldna do as he said, so he put out word that any slave who chose to join the army would be freed, and fed, clothed, and paid," he added, thinking that this was more than most continental soldiers could expect.
Anson nodded, his long young face serious.
All the McHughs were serious, save their mother, Adeline. And God knew the woman needed a sense of humour, with 7 bairns, all boys.
"Is it treason we're going to commit, then?"
Anson asked. A faint gleam of excitement came into his eyes at the thought.
"Very likely,"
Jamie said, and suppressed an inappropriate smile at the thought. He'd had a flash of memory, a contentious conversation between himself and John Grey on a road in Ireland.
Grey, annoyed by Jamie's refusal to tell him what he knew about Tobias Quinn's aims, had said,
"I suppose it is frivolous to point out that assisting the king's enemies, even by inaction, is treason."
To which he had himself replied evenly,
"It is not frivolous to point out that I am a convicted traitor. Are there judicial degrees of that crime? Is it additive? Because when they tried me, all they said was treason before putting a rope around my neck."
He was surprised to find that the inappropriate smile had crept onto his face, despite the current urgent situation and the fraught circumstances of the memory. A shout from Gilbride Macmillan made him turn sharply from Anson and kick his horse into the highest pace he could sustain on a slippery blanket of wet pine needles. Panting with the hurry, they reached Gilbride, who silently pointed the way with his chin. The soldiers had stopped by a small creek to water the horses. That was luck. He could see Ulysses standing on the near bank, leaning against a bare willow's trunk, the drooping leafless branches falling in a sort of cage about him. Taking that as a good omen, Jamie gathered his men and made his aims known. He let Anson McHugh shout,
"One, two, three!"
And on that signal the group split like a dropped egg, Gilbride and the McHughs going for the left flank, as it were, with himself and the Lindsays riding straight into the creek to split the group, and himself meaning to seize upon Ulysses. Kenny Lindsay to back him up if needed.
"Make sure of the horses," he shouted, leaning toward Kenny. "I dinna ken which one belongs to our man. It's the saddlebags I want." "Aye, McDo," Lindsay said, grinning,
and Jamie let out a Highland whoop that made Phineas, unused to such a thing, swerve madly, ears laid back. The black soldiers sprang up at once to defend themselves, but most of them were dismounted, and their horses hadn't liked the screech any more than Phineas did. Ulysses had started from his willow tree like a water rat flushed by a fox and dived for his tethered horse. Jamie pulled his own horse up into a slithering stop amid a shower of wet leaves and flung himself off. He ran through the creek edge, ignoring rocks and the cold water that splashed his legs, and threw himself at Ulysses just as the man was getting his left foot into the stirrup. His blood was up, and he dragged Ulysses away from the horse, shoved him, then punched him in the belly.
"Saddlebags!" he bellowed over his shoulder,
and got a glimpse of Kenny sliding off his own horse, preparing to make a run for the bags. The glimpse took his attention off his own business for a split second, and Ulysses hit him hard on the ear and pushed him backward into the creek. The cold water surging up through his clothes was as much a shock as the startling pain in his ear, but he got enough breath back to roll over and scramble clumsily to his feet. There was the boom of a pistol shot at close range. Kenny had fired at Ulysses but missed, and one of Ulysses' men dived at Kenny from behind and took his legs out from under him. The erstwhile butler had got halfway into the saddle. He booted his horse and shot straight into the creek toward Jamie, who leapt to the side, then fell again as a slippery stone rolled under his foot. The horse clipped him in the hip with a hind foot as he tried to rise and knocked him sprawling. He was too infuriated even to curse coherently. His left eye was watering profusely, and he dashed his sleeve over it, to no effect, the sleeve being sodden. The Lindsays had taken off in pursuit of Ulysses and the small group of his nearby soldiers. The McHughs had chased their own game away from the creek, up into a tangled growth of alders and hemlocks. He could hear shouts and the occasional ring of swords and gun barrels clashing. He didn't want any killing, and had